It's Sports Day Plus with Trey Elling.
Coming up on episode number 96 of Sports Day Plus. At 6:45, where are we at in society? Are you such a degen that you've prayed for the ability to bet on professional slap fighting, jiu-jitsu in a car, or putt-putt? Well, have I got good news for you. At 6:15, it is the first of my two-segment conversation with actor Alan Ruck, a.k.a. Cameron from Ferris Bueller's Day Off, on his screening of the classic film tomorrow at Moon Tower Comedy Festival at the Paramount Theater. You can go to austintheater.org for info and tickets. And a mere seconds, as Lane Kiffin jumped the shark with Ole Miss's final spring scrimmage. I take a look at the details. I am your host, Trey Elling. You can give me a follow on Twitter at Courtesy Wave and do the same for ESPN Austin at 1027 ESPN. I am making an executive decision with today's sports talk on Sports Day Plus. I am not going to talk about the Masters. You don't want to hear me talk about golf. My most profound opinion about golf, and especially the Masters, is that Master Sunday is one of the greatest napping days of the year because golf on TV is wonderful napping background noise. And with the Masters and as few commercials as are playing when that tournament is on over the weekend, makes it even more prime for that sort of activity. Nor am I going to beat you over the head with Shohei Ohtani's interpreter actually having stolen the money, according to the feds. I'm skeptical, but I just don't care to give you that opinion right now. Maybe next week. Maybe as things play out a little bit more. And I really don't care to laugh at the misery of Kentucky basketball right now either. People may be sleeping on former alumni Mark Pope taking the job after seemingly every other top-flight coach turned the gig down. I just don't care that much. What I do care about is Lane Kiffin's entertainment value as it pertains to college football and just some of the gems that he gives us in the sports media. Things to talk about. And that's what I'm leading today's show off with. If we have time this segment, I may also get into the Olympic wrestler who turned down a $300,000 bribe to deliberately lose a match, clearly not the WWE, and perhaps a sports agency run by Bad Bunny, the Puerto Rican musician, is facing MLBPA sanctions. Shocked that a musician's sports agency is not doing things upright according to the league that it supposedly works with. But we start with, yes, Joey Freshwater himself, Lane Kiffin, who has his team going through spring football right now and actually is holding the team's final spring scrimmage this weekend. They're calling this year's spring scrimmage in Oxford, Mississippi, the Grove Bowl Games. And that does put a bow on their 2024 spring practices. But it's not as simple as an actual game with arcane scoring rules. No, this year, instead of that traditional spring game that is actually airing, there is a version of it, I guess, that's airing on the SEC Network this weekend, replacing what has annually been known as the Grove Bowl, I guess, is a 7-on-7 competition that's consisting of four quarters. Between each quarter and halftime, there will be events, and that includes, at halftime, a hot dog eating competition with the hot dog eating goat, Joey Chestnut. That's right, the guy who has won 16 of the last 17 Nathan's hot dog eating contest is going to be the halftime show, I guess, in the center of the field. At Ole Miss, for the fans there, as the team rests for 15 to 20 minutes. 16 of 17, Nathan's hot dog eating contest. That is truly GOAT category right there. Kiffin was asked how he lined up Chestnut, and he said he slid into his DMs. Of course he did. A little bit disappointed Lane Kiffin isn't trying to participate in this year's hot dog eating contest. That was a different era of his life, and it most likely did not involve him consuming the hot dogs, but giving the hot dogs out. So the day starts at Ole Miss with a dunk contest. Then the first quarter of 7-on-7 play, which, by the way, they are eliminating the lines of scrimmage. They're turning this into what has become a very popular sport at the high school level that you hear college teams talk about practicing all the time in the offseason, is going through 7-on-7 and quarterbacks getting on the same page with their skill guys and the back end of the defense trying to figure things out as well. It's interesting. It's curious. It feels like the overall direction that even regular football may be going in, that at some point when we are no longer allowed to hit one another hard, much less tackle one another, that you just completely eliminate the line of scrimmage. There's rules about how the ball has to cross the line of scrimmage. But that's what Ole Miss is doing. Between the first and second quarters, there will be a tug of war, which you would imagine is between the offensive and defensive line, since they aren't playing in the 7-on-7. And an obstacle course event is going to split the third and fourth quarters. How might scoring goal go for the Grove Bowl games? Because you assume that if they're saying Grove Bowl games, the tally is going to come from all these different activities. Rosters being split into red and blue. Points from 7-on-7, of course, as well as points from the dunk contest, the hot dog eating competition, the tug of war and obstacle course. The 7-on-7 is going to feature traditional football scoring with touchdowns earning 6 points, a point after attempt for 1 point at the 5-yard line and 2 points at the 2-yard line. So the attempt isn't going to involve kickers even. Man, they are really down on the kicker at Ole Miss, apparently. Those who earn spots in the finals of the dunk contest notch a point for the respective team, and the winner earns another 7 points. So earns a touchdown, tug of war, split into 5 rounds, and the winning team of each round earns 5 points. Whoever wins the hot dog eating competition earns 12 more points for their team. Second place gets 7. Third place is awarded 3. I'm assuming that Joey Chestnut is just going to be shoving hot dogs in his pie hole for the hell of it. He's not on one team or the other, because that would not be fair to anybody else. 16 of 17 Nathan's hot dog eating competitions. Lane Kiffin's just trying to win himself one SEC title. Chestnut's going out there. Maybe he's giving a motivational speech to the team before the spring game, or the spring games, as it were, to get them fired up and to understand what it takes to be a champion, what the heart of a champion looks and sounds like. Now, I guess the serious explanation for why this is happening is that there's an emphasis on player health. And the spring practices, while you are trying to create a sort of competition, you're also going up against your brothers in arms too. So how hard do you want to go against one another? Do you want to risk an injury because one guy or another is trying to make a name for himself? That's kind of how it goes in football though. So I do wonder if this little patty cake version of the spring game doesn't backfire on Lane Kiffin. He doesn't have a team that shows a certain mettle, a certain toughness in crunch time. But Lane Kiffin will continue being Joey Freshwater, even if that's no longer how he's representing himself when at bars or maybe even on vacations. So you will have an opportunity to watch at least part of that on SEC Plus this weekend at 3 o'clock. Don't have time for those other stories. May get to those next week. That's because coming up, I have a very fun conversation with Alan Ruck. You know him from HBO's Succession. He was also Cameron in Ferris Bueller's Day Off. He's showing Ferris Bueller's Day Off as part of this year's Moon Tower Comedy Festival. It's happening tomorrow at the Paramount Theater at 3 o'clock. Still some tickets left to that. It is going to be followed by a Q&A with Alan. Go to austintheater.org to snag the tickets that remain. Coming up, my conversation with Alan over the course of a couple of segments here on Sports Day Plus.
It's Sports Day Plus with Trey Elling. It's Sports Day Plus with Trey Ellen.
Alan Ruck is a longtime actor who's been in everything from HBO's Succession, which earned him a Grammy nomination for Best Supporting Actor, to Ferris Bueller's Day Off, where he played the iconic character Cameron. It's the latter that is the focus of today's conversation, as Alan Ruck is presenting Ferris Bueller's Day Off at this year's Moon Tower Comedy Festival. It's happening tomorrow at the Paramount Theater at 3 o'clock, a screening of Ferris Bueller's Day Off, followed by a Q&A with Alan himself. Go to austintheater.org for the tickets that remain to that event. Also, more information. And Alan now joins me to talk about that and more. Alan, thank you so much for the time. How you doing today?
I'm fine. How you doing?
I'm great. And I don't know if you realize this or not, but this is actually the second time that you and I have a chance to chat. The first time was at South by Southwest a couple years ago when you were there in support of your wife, Mireille, and her excellent AMC show, Lucky Hank. You were just kind of standing off to the side, and I was waiting for Mireille and Bob and some of the other people to pass through. And I asked if you had a few minutes, and you did. And it was a very pleasant conversation. So it's great to get to talk to you again, man.
I'm glad I wasn't a jerk. That's the main thing. I think that was just about a year ago.
Was it only a year? Yeah. You know what? You're right about that. It was a year ago. I was thinking a couple of years because the last four have just been a blur, but it was a year ago.
Jam-packed.
Yeah. Did y'all get to experience much of Austin, or was it very much an in and out trip for you guys that weekend?
That one was pretty quick. Mireille years ago, I think about 9 years ago, did a pilot for ABC that was shot in Austin called The Catch.
Okay.
So we got to be there. We got to be there for, maybe three weeks. I enjoy it. It's a great town, man. It's gone crazy, right? It's just been built up so much so fast.
Yeah. This town has always had a sort of keep Austin weird charm. Of course, that's how the slogan goes. It feels a little bit less weird, but that's inevitable with a cool place. We just have to ensure that even if some of that mom and pop charm goes away, that the people who are moving here aren't necessarily bringing their problems with them, because this is a very open-minded place that loves its arts when it's all said and done.
Right. Yeah, I know. I enjoyed being there, and I like the vibe, to use an overused word, but I liked how I felt when I was in Austin. I felt very comfortable. Yeah.
Cool. Well, I know more than a couple of people who are excited about this Ferris Bueller screening that you are hosting on Saturday at Moon Tower Comedy Festival. It's at the Paramount, which is a great place to see a movie. There's going to be a Q&A afterwards as well. You've probably seen this more times than you care to admit in your life, but you've also been taking this show on the road too. How cool is it to see a movie like this still resonate with audiences nearly 40 years later now?
I know. I think it's a testament to John Hughes. And I think it's all about the respect he had for kids. You know, a lot of teen comedies from every era just don't hold up because they were making fun of the kids, you know, for being sex crazed or, you know, whatever. I mean, just silly stuff. And I just think John was fascinated by kids, and he honored them for being complete individuals, certainly, you know, in transition, like we all are. We're all works in progress. But I've said this before, that I think he honored their hopes and dreams and didn't write down to them or talk down to them. And I think that's why they still stand up.
Maybe passively, but I've kind of taken a cue with that with my own kids. I have a 9 and 7 year old right now, and I try and talk to them like human beings. Like we have this thought, and it's, look, I understand why mothers are nurturing. It's important that you have the nurturing of mothers and maybe the hard love of dad at times, but I like to be straight with them. I like to make sure that I'm having human conversations so they don't think that I'm putting them on. They don't think that I'm BSing them, to where when I really sit them down and say, look, please listen to me right now with this, that there's a little bit of respect that goes along with that.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, whatever's appropriate at their age, I think we should just tell them the truth. You know, I mean, there's some things that they're not ready for, and you don't want to overload a kid with stuff that's mind-boggling, you know, in terms of life or sex or whatever it is. But whatever is appropriate at any given age. I think you just got to be completely straight with them, you know. And then at the end of the day, you do get to play the dad card if you're in an argument with your kids, and then they say, "Why should I do that?" You can say, "Because I say so," and just, you know, you always have that in your hip pocket. So
that's last resort, but inevitably it has to be used sometimes, right?
That's it. I mean, you've been on the planet longer. You've been through things. There's some stuff that just is not up for discussion.
Yeah, no, you're right. And unfortunately my kids, cause they deadpan asked me and I'm like, "Do you really want to know the answer?" They were also the first kids in their respective classes to know the Santa Claus secret too.
Yeah. The cat's out of the bag.
So in another interview that I heard you do, you mentioned meeting Hughes for the very first time in the early 80s around the Breakfast Club. Was that because you had actually tried out for the Breakfast Club?
Yeah, I started acting in Chicago. I got there in 1979, fall of 79. And a couple of years later, you know, John had already written the Lampoon Vacation movies. And he had written the Breakfast Club early on, and he wanted to do it like a little low budget indie in Chicago. And I went in and I auditioned for Bender, which, you know, I wasn't right for. But anyway, I went in, I met him, I read for him. And then during that time, he met Molly Ringwald. And then he just, you know, she became his muse, and he put the Breakfast Club on the back burner. And he wrote 16 Candles for That Girl in a weekend. He was, I don't know that there's anybody that was faster than him in terms of screenwriting.
Didn't you say he wrote Ferris in like 7 or 10 days, something like that too?
I think it was under seven. I think it was just absolutely a week. He talked to Ned Tannen, who was running Paramount Pictures at the time, and he bounced this idea off of him, I think, about Bueller. And Ned said, "Well, you know, show me a script." And then within a week, it was on Tannen's desk. So you read for
Bender. Do you remember the the lines that you had to read?
Oh no, man! It's 40 years ago. I don't know.
Hey, no. Did you dig to your inner depths to find the badassness necessary to pull Bender off?
I think I did what I could, you know. But clearly, it was not meant to be. It went another way, as they say.
And learning a little bit more about you for this conversation, Alan, I love to hear about your Chicago past. This is actually a running joke for me here in Austin, but I bring up my Chicago past all the time. I had the pleasure of living in Chicago from my early 30s until my late 30s, met my now wife then. We had our first kid there and eventually moved back to Texas, which is where I am from. But I will always cherish my time in Chicago. The city itself is amazing, obviously, but it really helped me to become comfortable in my own skin as a human being. Why does Chicago hold a soft spot in your heart?
Well, I was born and raised in Cleveland, in a suburb of Cleveland, Ohio. And Chicago is sort of like the big world-class version of all those Midwest cities of Cleveland, Detroit, Buffalo. It has a lot of that. I mean, New York is its own thing, and Los Angeles, being on the coast, it's not. I don't think they're entirely representative of sort of the United States experience. But Chicago has that Midwest vibe, but it is a big, gorgeous, world-class city.
Yeah.
And when I got to Chicago, I went to the University of Illinois downstate. When I got to Chicago, all of a sudden, I felt like all things were possible. Everything that city has to offer, it has a personality, just like New Orleans has a personality. New Orleans, the great food, great music, its own sort of patois, you know, its own sort of slang. Chicago's the same way. It's got this great history, fabulous food, amazing restaurants, great music, and the arts. I mean, you're talking about Austin, loving the arts. I mean, Chicago is just, it's a nurturing place. And that's what it opened up for me. Now, my wife, Mireille, started out in New York. So New York holds that same kind of magical spot for her. And maybe it's because we were young when we got to our respective places, and that's where things started to happen for us, that we have those fond memories. But Chicago is, it has a big place in my heart.
Well, you mentioned all the different places for artistic expression. Maybe, I don't even know if it's an underrated theater. I hadn't heard of it before I moved to Chicago, but the Steppenwolf is a world-class theater production, and that was part of your initiation into the acting world too, wasn't it?
Well, I showed up, those guys are just a couple of years older than me.
Okay.
I mean the original members. I got to Chicago. The very first play I ever saw when I got there was a production of Waiting for Lefty, and it was the Steppenwolfers. And, you know, I was feeling pretty good about myself. I was 23 years old. I thought I knew what I was doing. And I see these guys that are just a couple of years older than me. Not only were they mind-blowingly talented, but they were charting their own course. They were just waiting for somebody to call them in for an audition. They had this company, and they were like charting their own destiny. They were making it happen. A very impressive group of people. And those guys, Gary Sinise and Terry Kinney and Jeff Perry, the three guys that started the whole thing when they were like 18, you know, they're so smart because they knew that separately they were good, they were talented, but they knew together they were amazing, you know, and that they had an incredibly deep bench. It was just one person after another who was a wonderful actor, and it's just some of the most exciting stuff I've seen on stage.
He is Alan Ruck. We're going to talk a little more Chicago on the other side, as well as Ferris Bueller's Day Off. It's the film that he's showing at this year's Moon Tower Comedy Festival tomorrow at 3 o'clock at the Paramount Theater. There are still tickets left for this, which includes a Q&A with Alan after the fact. Go to austintheater.org to snag those tickets or for more info. Coming up, one more segment with Alan Ruck on the other side here on Sports Day Plus.
It's Sports Day Plus with Trey Elling. It's Sports Day Plus with Trey Elling.
Back for one more segment with actor Alan Ruck. You know him from HBO's Succession and as Cameron in Ferris Bueller's Day Off. He's actually presenting Ferris Bueller's Day Off at this year's Moon Tower Comedy Festival, followed by a Q&A with Alan. That is tomorrow at the Paramount Theater at 3 o'clock. There are still tickets left to this. You can go to austintheater.org to snag those. And Alan, we were just talking about Chicago, your experience there, working at the Steppenwolf Theater with guys like Gary Sinise. And you give Gary and John Malkovich a lot of credit for helping you to understand what the blueprint was for really advancing your acting career too, correct?
Well, you know, like everybody, they really started to blow up. They started to get really, really big right about the time I got to Chicago, like in that next year. And it wasn't too long that they started taking productions to New York. And so I just saw these guys doing great work and, you know, like homegrown guys, too. I mean, they weren't real Hollywood, or they weren't part of that New York scene where everybody seems to have a pedigree from Yale or Juilliard or NYU. It's just like they sprung up out of the mud, you know, and so we were all inspired. Every actor of my generation who started in Chicago, incredibly impressed and inspired by the Steppenwolf gang. And it was like, how do you do this? And they just stood up and did it. And it's like, that's how you be an actor. That's how you do it.
So with all of that being said, and just thinking about how cool a city Chicago is, and it truly is unique too. I mean, there are big cities in this country that people hold fondly, whether you're talking about a New York or a Los Angeles, a San Francisco. I think Dallas and Houston certainly have their charm. I mean, you could go down the list. Chicago is its own thing. And in my opinion, one of the top two or three as a result of the mix of big city with a sort of Midwestern niceness to make up a word on the spot here.
Yeah.
Does it feel pretty good all these years later to have been such an important part of a movie that still is seen as the seminal film, or in that category of seminal films of what makes Chicago so great as a city? Because you can argue that the Blues Brothers is on that list too, but this is a more modernized version of that. And I think a more approachable version for the average person watching that film who wants to go do some of those cool things in Chicago eventually.
Well, that again, it was all John Hughes. I mean, he he really adored Chicago, and you know, rightfully so. And in many ways, Buehler is a love letter to his city. But there's just, you know, what's not to like about Chicago? Well, here's one thing: the weather. That's the only thing to this day. I mean, I'm an older guy now, and I just don't want to shovel snow, and I don't want to wrap up in, you know, 100 layers just to go to the grocery store. So I'm a baby. I live in Los Angeles, and I like it. I like California. But Chicago is certainly one of the prettier cities I've ever seen. San Francisco right now is going through some things because they have an out of control homeless population. And it's not just, it's a problem for all of us in every big city. And,
you're not in a good place as a city when you have an online map dedicated to the largest amounts of human excrement, like what San Francisco is dealing with right now.
Yeah. But I mean, I always thought that maybe San Francisco was the prettiest American city. And it still is. We've all got this homelessness issue to deal with, and we've got to figure it out because these people really need help, and it's impacting, you know, the quality of life for everyone. So, I mean, that's a whole nother story.
Well, the hands-off approach is bad for everybody. I completely agree with you because Austin deals with a version of it as well. Just hearing no evil, seeing no evil by our government officials is an unacceptable quote unquote solution. Right.
Right. But, you know, San Francisco, gorgeous city, and Chicago's right up there. They years ago were very smart. They developed the whole lakefront as a park and gorgeous architecture. And then after the Great Fire of 1871, wasn't it 1871?
Yep.
They started to build everything out of brick and stone. So even like the corner store, like the mom and pop store on the corner, it's usually... it was built during that period of like the 1880s, a lot of these buildings, and they're just gorgeous, you know, that they're built out of brick and stone. They were made to last. So the city's got a great deal of charm, a lot of character.
Yeah. And as you'll learn, if you ever go on the architecture cruise, most of the buildings downtown have context of the buildings next to them. So there's a certain cohesiveness. One exception, of course, is the Trump Tower, which looks like a giant needle to the brain and has no context as compared to anything else. Shouldn't surprise anybody knowing that now.
Yeah. Well, it was made to stick out.
Yeah. Yes, it was. I'm with you, by the way, on the winter. That was my only really big gripe. Well, the politicians were a little bit of a problem, too. But 6 to 8 months of winter for the possibility of anywhere from 6 weeks to 2 months of summer, that trade-off no longer became worth it for me as soon as we had a kid. Yeah. And our freedom was going to start going downhill pretty quickly as adults anyhow, you know?
Yeah. I mean, the month of May and the month of October generally in Chicago are glorious, you know, but you're going to pay for it.
Do you have a favorite element of just what you were able to do with the Cameron character all these years later? I know you don't like watching the young version of yourself acting things out. You get very nitpicky, which is completely understandable. I hate listening to myself when I have to go back and edit conversations. So I do understand and not wanting to go do that, especially not wanting to go do that decades in the past, but is there something that sticks with you all these years later about that performance, Alan?
I guess I'm really pleased that I allowed myself to relax into it. I mean, I worked hard, I prepared, but I mean, what you really need to do is you plan your work, but then I had an acting teacher that said, once they say action, what you got to do is you got to jump off the diving board and see what happens. And so I think we had a fair bit of spontaneity in that movie. And I hadn't had that much movie experience, film experience at that point, but I felt good about that. I felt like it was pretty spontaneous, and that's kind of what I'm always hoping for.
You guys were actually at the Cubs game.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
So what were the circumstances surrounding the parade? Was that on Michigan? Where was that? Was there an actual parade planned, or was that Hughes just doing a great job of coordinating things?
Well, I think that's why they decided to shoot in Chicago at that time, because there really was a German-American Day parade during the time that we were in Chicago. Mm. And so one Saturday we were just part of the parade, and we had our own little float, and we would sneak, you know, we sort of sneak into the line of the parade, and the cameras were set up, and we'd go a couple of blocks, and then we'd duck down a side street and get back onto the end of the parade. And then, you know, and that was the whole first Saturday. And then a week later, we did all the close-ups of, all, you know, Matthew singing with the girls on the parade, all the close-ups of that. We did the scenes with Mia and I. And then a great guy named Kenny Ortega was the choreographer and second unit director. And he did all those great things with the people dancing down the steps and, you know, construction workers dancing and, you know, panning the crowd. They did all that stuff. So it probably, it took at least three full days of work to film that parade sequence. Yeah.
Last Bueller question now, Alan. Have you ever been to Egypt land?
No, I have not. No, I have not.
And just a couple quick questions on Succession. Obviously, modern audiences know you from Succession. You did a phenomenal job on that show. Such a great show. You described working on that show as addicting. What was so addicting about being a part of that cast and production over the last several years?
The writing. I mean, I think all of us are just spoiled rotten now. And I mean, there's a lot of wonderful writers out there, a lot of talented people producing great stuff. But our whole writer's room, they were all award-winning playwrights and people who had created television series and written movies in their own right. And then they were all gathered together in this room by Jesse Armstrong, and just the you knew exactly where, when you read the script, you knew exactly where your character was. You knew exactly what you were supposed to be thinking. It was just a very sort of detailed roadmap of what to do. And then the other thing is we had an amazing cast, a bunch of talented people. We had terrific directors, and it was just a blast to watch other people do their thing. It was, the whole thing was just thrilling.
And yeah. Were you happy with how the show ended?
Yeah, I mean, I think Jesse was right. He originally thought it was just going to be a 3-season show. And then it turns out they had a little bit more story to tell. Mm. There was a rumor at one point, one of our writers, Georgia Pritchett, said in an interview that the series would be at least 4, but certainly no more than 5 seasons long. And I think just because I love the people and the whole thing. I mean, you know, there's no great hardship to be on a show that everybody says is wonderful. You know, it does something for your self-esteem. So if it had been possible, sure, I would have liked another season. But I think Jesse was smart to end it when he did. And we went out on a real high note. And we didn't, you know, wind up jumping the shark in any way.
Very well said there. He is Alan Ruck. You can check out Alan here in Austin this week, and you can actually hang out with him through Ferris Bueller's Day Off and a Q&A afterwards as part of Moon Tower Comedy Festival. Moon Tower Comedy Festival started yesterday and goes all the way through next weekend. And Alan Ruck presents Ferris Bueller's Day Off this Saturday, April 13th at 3:00 at the Paramount. Go to austintheater.org to snag tickets for more info. Alan, real pleasure getting to catch up with you again. Thank you so much for the time, and safe travels to and from Austin this weekend.
All right. Thanks, buddy. It's nice to see you again.
Coming up in Where Are We At in Society, have you ever wanted to bet on slap fights or guys trying to choke each other out with jiu-jitsu in a car or maybe even mini golf? Well, congratulations. Now you have your chance. I'll tell you about it up next here on Sports Day Plus.
It's Sports Day Plus with Trey Elling. It's Sports Day Plus with Trey Elling.
Final segment of today's show means it's time for
Where Are We At in Society Today?
That's right. It is your regular look at stories that show we as a people are headed in the wrong direction. Very occasionally, I will bring you a story that provides a sense of optimism that has us all saying to ourselves, hey, maybe we as a people are starting to figure something out, but sadly, today is not that day. And we start in the world of gambling for today's Where Are We At stories. Are you such a degenerate that football, men's and women's basketball, baseball, all sorts of college sports, perhaps Olympic sports, aren't quite doing enough for you as a gambler of sports. Well, congratulations are in order if you are in that category of degeneracy. Because there is a new gambling network that has more in the way of obscure sports for you to place and lose money on. The network is called the Pro League Network, and it advertises itself as offering obscure sports that bettors can target. From the co-founder, Mike Selvaris, via the New York Post, Pro League Network is a portfolio of niche and emerging sports that we own competitively and we operate for a sports entertainment and betting audience. What sports do they own, you might ask? How about a pro mini golf league, pro slap fighting, and car jiu-jitsu, which is what it sounds like, and we will get to more of those details here shortly. They've also partnered, the Pro League Network that is, with Kevin Garnett in a 3-versus-3 basketball league called Street, but each of the E's is actually a 3 to let you know that it's 3-on-3. Although that looks like a 33, and is there some sort of Larry Bird connotation? There's not, as far as I know. It's just another 3-on-3 basketball league. Maybe KG is not trying to do what Ice Cube has, and that's take former NBA players and offer very popular women's players way more money than they'll make in the WNBA to go up against one another every summer. KG's league may be a little bit more competitive in terms of younger guys who are perhaps not quite good enough for the NBA. And as I mentioned, the Pro League Network, their entire business model is about sports gambling. And they believe, according to Salvaris again, quote, "We prioritize gambling because there's a lot of overlap in the professional sports calendar here in the U.S. There's not really a lot of good domestic content to bet on like a Monday afternoon, Tuesday, Wednesday, or Thursday." Monday, they're going for the afternoon sports gambling crowd, the midweek afternoon sports gambling crowd. It's amusing, if nothing else. It is. And I don't know. Is there enough of a market? Are people itching that badly to bet on sports or bet on competition that they're going to throw a sawbuck on the pro slap fighting championships, which are very entertaining, I agree. To watch little clips on social media, watching guys slap the ever-loving you-know-what out of one another, some of whom end up getting knocked out briefly before standing back up, getting their whips about them, and then trying to slap their competitor in return. It is amusing. Once, maybe twice, but then it gets really sad really fast. Pro League Network, open about trying to capitalize on a lack of daytime weekday sporting events. Yeah, sure, you've got basketball at night and baseball at night. Ah, there's some midweek baseball day games. Not for hockey, not for basketball. Football hasn't gone 7 days a week just yet, or 7 nights a week, much less 7 days per week. So we've got you covered, D-Gen. We're even more vertically integrated. Boy, is that a corporate term that I've come to despise in the last few years. We're vertically integrated, though, because we own the facilities in which we are producing sports. We have a studio in Branson, Missouri, where we produce a lot of our combat sports. From the athletes to the cameraman to everything, we are in control of that distribution. So let's get back to car jiu-jitsu. It is exactly what you're probably picturing right now. Salvaris talks about car jiu-jitsu. Everyone thinks it's kind of crazy that we're filming a couple of guys grappling in a car, but it's bloody compelling. Salvaris must be British. We have spent a lot of time on the safety side, perfecting all the rules with the sanctioning body, a few tweaks here or there, and a few pass outs with the seatbelt choke. That's right, the seatbelt can be used to choke a competitor out. And this network has found some traction on social media. I just admitted that I'll watch slap fighting from time to time. Again, one or two slaps that knocks the other person out, then I start to get a little sick to my stomach. I am genuinely curious to know or to see a moment from car jiu-jitsu where somebody chokes the other person out with a seatbelt. I feel like the same nauseous feelings will eventually come over me if I watch too much of that. I know. My bloodlust is, it's low. There's no way I would have lasted in ancient Roman times. Shouldn't be shocking at all. I understand why people like the UFC. I understand why people still watch boxing to the lengths that they do. I used to love boxing back in the day. Not going to call it a less corrupt sport back then, but it was really the only game in town. I just, my desire to watch a whole lot of that, to fill my eyes, my brain with a lot of that stuff, of watching people blatantly hurt one another, it's pretty low. I mean, it begins with football, obviously. Kind of ends with football at this point as well. But there are a lot of other people that feel otherwise. And a lot of people who apparently have enough disposable income that they can just bet it will. I think about my friends that have the possibility of drinking, drugs, sex, or gambling issues, like the one thing that might derail most of their lives. And keep in mind, I'm in my mid-40s right now. It's far and away gambling. Far and away gambling. So I am in the minority here by far. I completely understand that. And now that I think about it, some of them do place regular money on WNBA games. I know a guy who bet on American Idol back when American Idol was at its most popular in the mid-aughts because he had to watch it with his wife and daughters and he needed to liven things up just a little bit. It's like we can't sit there and just be bored or admit that a game isn't exciting enough to watch on its own to find something that is. We put some action on it, and all of a sudden, there's an emotional investment. The win or loss of $100 based on whether the... what's a WNBA team? I apologize. The Boise Fever. The Boise River? I'm not sure what the team name is. But the team from Boise, whether they can hit their free throws down the stretch. Now you may not have to worry about that. About suffering through another mediocre basketball game. By the way, this goes to the NBA during the regular season as well. Let's not make it seem like I'm just picking on the WNBA here. My point is that there are some guys that I know in the past that years ago were betting on the WNBA just to have something to watch and root for at night. Now, you can scratch that itch during the daytime by betting on one guy slapping another guy so hard that he passes out and ultimately... does he wave the white flag? Does he call uncle? I'm not sure how slap fighting is won or lost. I always assumed that it had to do with the guy getting knocked out. But guys get knocked out, somebody catches them like a trust fall, and then they get propped back up to hopefully be able to swing at the face of their competitor. So I don't know if temporary knockouts count for points. I'm starting to get way too curious here. Clearly, this network is having an effect on me. And I do still want to see the car jiu-jitsu, too. Can you bet on whether a guy gets choked out by the seatbelt? What about his head getting pinned up against the car dash? Can the center console be used if it's one of those center consoles that slides back and forward? Back opens it up, forward closes it. Can you trap your competitor's head in that? Perhaps forcing them to tap out at that point. You bet on that. Can the steering wheel be used for leverage? Are you allowed to lock the car doors if somebody's trying to escape you? Or are you allowed to open the car doors to begin with? I may need to further explore car jujitsu? Because I have a lot of questions right now. This may require some radio play-by-play for you next week, just so I can make sure we're all clear on what the hell car jujitsu is. And with that, we conclude another week's worth of Sports Day Plus. Couple quick programming reminders for next week. Coming up, there will be several other comedians taking part in Moon Tower Comedy Festival. That includes two of my favorites, Ari Shaffir and Brad Williams, who will be at the Paramount Theater the following weekend. Brad's on the 19th. Ari is on April 20th. You do not want to miss those. Also, Miss Pat coming up on the show next week. She is also hilarious if you have not heard from her before, and does a really good sitcom too on BET+. In the meantime, thank you so much for listening to today's show. I will be back on Monday at 6. In the meantime, have yourselves a great weekend and hook 'em.
It's Sports Day Plus with Trey Ellie.